Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, Drea Kaufman.
Hello.
That was very British of you. Very fitting.
Oh, thank you.
Hello.
I wasn't even trying to do that, but that I guess you're right. So, hello there.
You're going to invite us for a spot of tea now.
Ooh. You know, honestly, it is the warm part of the year here where I live. And right now, you know, we haven't moved to our new house, so I don't have air conditioning. And it's like 84 outside. Yesterday it was in the 90s. So I don't really want tea. Unless it's iced tea.
Iced
tea. Give me some sweet tea from Chick-fil-A and we'll be talking. So, yeah.
Even so, tea, caffeine, that makes your heart run, which makes your internal body temperature raise.
That's
so, like, even though it's iced, it may not be the best beverage for a non-air conditioned environment.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I want a nice fruit smoothie. We'll do a nice smoothie. That sounds good.
You know what's really cool, too, is that we got a new review on Apple Podcasts.
Ooh, and, I like it.
This one is from, I'm going to say Amzeem. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it. Sometimes it's hard to pronounce, the names people come up with themselves on Apple Podcasts. But they said favorite. 5 stars. These two are insightful, fun, witty, and delightfully nerdy as they analyze Harry Potter. I love their thoughts and analysis. It adds a new layer of enjoyment to the text and always gives me something to think about.
Aw, thank you. That's awesome. And I agree. I never try to pronounce people's names on, like, usernames on stuff. I always butcher it. So, that's awesome. I think it's really great. And I love that people like us. It makes me happy.
It's nice
to hear. We always, I mean, them and others, we keep finding new viewers, even though we're real far deep or elbows deep into this crazy world of Harry Potter. And, you know, I love that we still bring along more people. So it's all, and it's great to hear from them. I know we say that every time we get something, but I love hearing from them. So thank you for taking the time.
Yeah. I mean, it never gets old, people telling you you're doing a good job. So we appreciate the fact that people spend a few moments to let us know. And also, you know, it also helps other people find the show. So you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere. You can get podcasts. Make sure you're subscribed. You'll get the show as soon as it drops. You can find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. We're on Instagram at Nerd Party. At the Nerd Party, that is. You can also find us online at thenerdparty.com. We've got so many shows happening that you can check out. And you can go to the contact section and you can send an email to Drea and I through that. And so many different ways to catch up with us. But this is a jam-packed chapter. I mean, the wedding, it's happening. And I do love that, we do get Harry here in Polyjuice Potion, and he is a cousin Barney, and basically he's just a local redheaded muggle boy who lives in the village not far away from the Weasleys, but they're calling him Barney, you've got a great number of Weasley relatives, and that should camouflage him. He just fits right in.
I know. I love, I always think of this part when he takes the Polyjuice Potion. I'm like, he's dressing to the nines. Like, that's part of what he puts on, right?
Yep.
And I love how being able to be folded into this Weasley family and no one's really going to ask any questions is so just widely accepted as a good practice. Like, I think that's just so funny. And it works,
you know,
I think there's
really,
like, one or two people who kind of ask questions throughout the chapter about it. I love later in the chapter, about midway through, one of the uncles gets drunk and keeps trying to ask Harry if he's his son.
Yeah. Which is really funny.
And Aunt Muriel kind of raises an eyebrow at it. For whatever reason, I can't say that name. Raises a little bit of an eyebrow at it, but doesn't think too hard about it, because as we come to learn about her character, that doesn't really fall into her scope of something that has interest to her. It's not sensational enough, right? And so,
well, I mean, it might be sensational if she knew that she was talking to the real Harry Potter.
She knew, yeah. Right? Which she takes a stab at him early on in the chapter too, about, you know, kind of takes a stab at both Ron and Harry all at once there. But yeah, it's a great cover, and they missed that opportunity in the movies to do that, because I think that could be. Yep. So it's so important when you think about it, it just makes sense. Like, it's just so safe. Right. Like, why else would you invite all of these people, including Victor Crumb and the Lovegoods, right? They really expand this bubble outside of what they're comfortable with. But in the movies, they never, ever they never disguise him. He's just there. So I love that she does that in the book, because it makes so much sense. And ever since I read the book, that's one of those few things that stuck with me watching the movies that I disagreed with. Is that they didn't take those precautions, considering the level of precautions they take to get him out of his house. Like, you would think.
I mean, somebody died for it, right? Literally.
Yeah.
Two
and somebody
people,
lost an ear.
Because Hedwig died too. So.
Yeah. I mean, that was such a just crazy situation. So, I love it. And I do love that she does a beautiful job of giving you an idea of what it looks like. And it feels so serene and peaceful. There's lots and lots of gold. Which I don't know elsewhere, but I haven't seen as a huge wedding color, at least in Arizona. I think it could be really beautiful here in Arizona, though, now that I come to think of it. But I just love the way she paints the picture of what's going on, too. And everything feels like you're there at the wedding. It seems like it's a big wedding.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does seem like it's a big affair. There are a lot of people there. I love the joke of the twins being like, oh, fighting over who's going to help the Vila cousins, you know, to their tables, which we also find out later on that Fred and George have also disappeared with the Vila cousins. So, getting wedding lucky, I guess. I mean, there's tons of people there. Like you mentioned, we've got the Lovegoods are there. Tonks and Lupin are there. And then, of course, so many family, so much family and friends. It's interesting. We get another moment where, you know, Tonks and Lupin run into Harry and, you know, they know who he is, and they kind of apologize for having to run out the other night. And, you know, Harry's like, it's okay, you know, because they talk about how the ministry is very anti-werewolf right now. And Lupin still is just not looking himself to Harry. He kind of looks like, his face is full of lines and misery, as Harry notes. But he honestly doesn't have time to think about that, because there's just so much happening here at the wedding. Like, Hagrid accidentally sits in the wrong chair and crushes about four of them, and they have to fix those. And, like, there's so many people. He runs in, like, to the Lovegoods, which my favorite part is that Luna knows exactly who he is, even through the disguise. And he's like, whoa. No, I'm Barney. She's like, oh, you changed that too. He's like, how did you know? Oh, just the expression. And it was just, oh my gosh, Luna is the funniest, most perfect character in this. And, you know, I think that's one thing that the movies got so right, was not only her, but who plays her father, because Xenophilius is just as quirky and interesting as his daughter is.
I'd say more so. She goes into the, like, oh, I'm waving my arms for anyone who can tell. Like, very, like, oh, she's very got a serene sort of weirdness to her. And he has almost a frantic one, right? So it almost comes on weird than his daughter, right? Because she can kind of calmly communicate everything. They always say she says in a sing-songy voice, and he definitely does not have that characteristic. And so, you know, I think there's a big difference.
Well, and apparently he's also a expert in his research on gnome magic. So there you go.
Yeah. I do love, though, that in that sense, I think it really shows sort of Luna's a weird and kind of an odd duck and has all her you know, quirks that we love about her, but it also shows she has like a real intuition that is stronger than any other character, right? Because she can immediately identify Harry and his expression, but she's got, and she already knew he would be in disguise and that would make sense. And this would make, like, she could rationalize all that very quickly because she has this sort of real insight into people and their mannerisms and things like that that a lot of other characters don't have. And mm-hmm. it's very unique for her to be able to do that, right? Because this isn't any sort of magical gift. It's just a very intuitive approach to the way she interacts with people, probably out of necessity. So I do love that. And I love that she gets this little moment where she's just clever, more clever than the tricks that they can mm-hmm. design, right?
Yeah.
She can't be fooled. And I think that will serve them well in the long run.
I love that you end up having this run-in with Aunt Muriel, Harry does, and, you know, like you said, she takes a dig at Harry and Ron. He helps her to the seat, and Ron comes over to Harry, he's like, don't worry, she's awful to everyone. And then we find out she was rude to Hermione as well, you know, because her and Ron are kind of together, and so she makes a you know, the statement about her being a muggle and skinny ankles. Like, just, this woman is the classic older, probably rich aunt, which she is rich, we find out, who is believes that her money gives her the opportunity to be able to say whatever she wants without anybody being able to do anything about it. And I think if you looked up the definition of snob, Aunt Muriel's picture might be there in the dictionary, because that's exactly what she is and how she comes off. It's just, she is that obnoxious snob who only thinks that her opinion is the one that matters.
Yeah, she does. She also has this air, and I think it's something that a lot, when we talk about the different sort of age groups in a society or a culture, right, there always are groupings. You can call them millennials or boomers or Gen X or Gen Y or whatever the new one is, Gen Z, right? I feel like she's also sort of representing this idea that she's lived so long, she's learned everything she's going to learn, she knows everything there is to know. And she doesn't have to give a flying flip anymore because, you know, she's seen it all. She's done it all. She's paid her dues. There's a real attitude there that I think is real and relatable. And I think a lot of people can know people who share that same attitude. And, you know, we see it in the news right now. And so I think she sort of represents that whole chunk of a culture in one sort of super annoying character that you really just dislike. You know, she even takes a stab at the bride for being French, yeah. Right? Like, oh, but did she have to be French? Yes, ma'am. Yes, she did. And as this chapter progresses, we just kind of also see that she really only, she thrives on the gossip mm-hmm. and the sensationalism yeah. and things that are salacious, right? Like, that's her bread and butter. So you have to take everything she says with a grain of salt, because she's always going to look for a reason mm-hmm. to dig at someone. She's always going to be looking for the latest piece of gossip and the things she can feel important by having. So she's just not a great, I just don't like, I mean, she's a great character. She's just not a character I like. But we get a whole bunch of her in this chapter, especially mm-hmm. after the ceremony yep. and at the reception. So Aunt Muriel is kind of a B.
Yeah, she is a witch with a capital B. So, you know, it's funny because, I think my favorite part of this chapter, and what I liked about this chapter, is that for a good half of it, there's a lot of laughs and there's a lot of fun. When they start talking about they wished their Uncle Bilious was there, and how, like, he would drink an entire bottle of fire whiskey and then start getting out on the dance floor and apparently pulling flowers from his, I don't know what.
Tough guess is what I took that as.
And I just love that Hermione's like, sounds like a real charmer, and Harry's dying with laughter. And Ron, I picture it in deadpan as, he never married for some reason. And Hermione turns to him and says, you amaze me. It was the funniest thing in this yeah. chapter. And then right before that, when they're Ron tells Hermione, you look great. And she turns to him and says the same thing he did earlier to her in this book. Always the tone of surprise. And it's like, you can, I think one of the things that's often overlooked is I think the way in which Ron and Hermione actually do fit together very well. They complement mm-hmm. each other very well. You know, they help each other with some of the, where they're weakest, really. And I think one of the things you can really see is that I think Ron helps Hermione have a little bit more fun and like mm-hmm. be a little less uptight. Like we've really seen her come into her own and she feels so much more comfortable with herself. And like that comment, you amaze me. Just those two together with that, those two comments. Like I, that wish that needed to have been in the movie because it's so funny. It's so funny.
They have a really good repartee between them and they do. They really compliment each other. And it's one of those situations where they sort of push each other to be better. He pushes her to be, you know, less uptight and more comfortable and, mm-hmm. and experience things a little bit more. And, you know, she pushes him more academically and challenges, you know, she challenges the things he says and he thinks. And I think we all need that person yeah. in our life who's willing to challenge our beliefs and challenge the approach we're taking to make sure, let us reevaluate if it's the correct way to go, right? And I think to some extent, you could almost argue that Ginny and Harry don't have that dynamic, right? But they kind of are all both sort of self-motivating in that sense. You know, Harry's kind of constantly challenging himself and questioning himself, you know, so in that sense he doesn't really need that approach. But you know, I think that exists so strongly between Hermione and Ron, and I think that's kind of where you talk about the old adage of opposites attract, right? They're not completely opposite, but they have, you know, opposing strengths that really benefit each other. And you know, they complement each other. And I think it's super cute. And I think that they're going so strong. And then all of a sudden, we have an old pal from book four show up and throw a little bit of a wrench into the party. Mm-hmm. And it's Victor Crumb, who I love reading his dialogue, by the way, because all the W's become V's. And I can't help but read it in his voice. Yeah,
it's
pretty great.
I love it. I love him being back. I think it's really funny. He actually adds a lot of humor, you know, because he asks about like Hermione and if her and Ron are together, and Harry's like, yeah, pretty much. And then he asks about. He points out Ginny and, you know, mentions how pretty she is. And like, is she seeing somebody? And Harry's like, oh yeah, big dude, big bloke. You don't want to mess with him. So that's really funny. And so, and then his comment of like, what's the point of being an international Quidditch star if all the good girls are taken?
I know. I think it's really funny because you have to imagine she's got a bunch of Velas here, right?
Yes.
He's picked the two women he can't have, right? Or others don't want him to have. That sounds so sexist. He picks the two women who are unavailable.
Yes. The Vela twins are off with the, cousins. They're off with the Weasley twins. So, you know, he's just out of luck, you know?
He's S.O.R.
Yep, that's pretty much what it is. So,
yeah, I do think that's funny, too, though. I do think that it's so good because Harry spends quite a bit of the wedding really fighting that connection to Ginny. Right. She mm-hmm. winks at him during the ceremony and he finds himself sort of watching her dance. And she's dancing with Lee Jordan and he's feeling some, you know, jealousy pains and has to remind himself that what he promised Ron and then, you know, Victor. And I think he's just like, you know what? No one's going to know. I'm just going to tell him no.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I've had my cap. I've done all I can. Yep.
It's pretty funny. I do love the moment, you know, that we get to see the wedding. And like you were saying, how beautiful it is. And I've Aunt Muriel talking about how her tiara sets it off, but how Ginevra's dress is too low cut.
Too low cut.
And I'm like, dang, Ginny. You know, Yeah. So Ginny's my favorite.
Yeah,
so.
But if she's like any other grandparent parent, it could be like literally just not a turtleneck and it's exactly. too low cut, you know? So, I mean, you gotta take it with a grain of salt. But regardless, I think it tells you the fact that Ginny is, you know, particularly beautiful in this moment and in a different light than we're used to seeing her.
I mean, she's wearing a dress. She doesn't normally wear a dress. So,
and heels, yeah. I think. So. Yeah. I mean, that's just not Ginny's character. Right. So,
well, and
go ahead.
What I love about that is that I think we've all experienced that thing where you get to see somebody in a different light, you know? And it's like you already liked them before, but then you're just completely bowled over. And that's kind of what happens to Harry. He just starts daydreaming about their, you know, moments at the castle when they were getting to hang out every day together. And then he's kind of brought back, you know, so.
I do love, though, we were talking a little bit about Victor Krum here. And I do love that the way they use him, right? Because he's not only meant to be a little bit of a kink in chain for Hermione and Ron, but he also provides quite a bit of valuable information during the reception, right? And I think it's a great way to deliver information that's pertinent to the story in somewhat of a expository way that doesn't feel expository, right? And she hasn't really been able to do this since the beginning of the series because we're too far in it for Harry to really be justified in asking, well, what's that? I don't know. And to need the explanation, right? And so we kind of come back to that again, and he kind of highlights two really important parts. One is a symbol that Lovegood is wearing around his neck, and the other is he kind of helps connect the dots for Grindelwald. Grigorovitch. Yeah. He connects the dots for Grigorovitch for Harry when he pulls out his wand. And I think those are two incredibly important elements that we need to kind of continue moving forward with the greater plot unfolding. It's a kind of a not in your face way of doing that. And that's why we say like there's so much happening in this chapter is because that's only two of the important things happening in the chapter.
Yeah, that,
but they're big.
I mean, it's huge because, you know, he sees Xenophilius wearing a medallion on, like, you know, and this symbol, he says, is a symbol of dark arts. You know, that he's seen it at Drumstring, you know, for his, you know, entire run at school there. And then it was Grindelwald's sign. So, and Grindelwald being one of the worst dark wizards who had, you know, fought Dumbledore and... So I think that's fascinating. It's fascinating because...
It's also fascinating with that, too, because she highlights that there sort of is a continental difference, right? He mentions, oh, you guys didn't really see it much over here, but it's big where I'm from. Like, it was big at our school. My grandfather died, right? He really highlights, too, this sort of cultural difference and that, like, the British version of the Wizarding World is not the only version of the Wizarding World kind of out there, right? It's not the only culture known.
Well, and it goes to show you, I mean, the fact that Grindelwald was not a really big deal in Britain has to do with Albus Dumbledore. And he even calls that out, you know, especially since apparently their last fight, Dumbledore wins handedly. So, you know, now at this point, you're just ready for that to be played out in the Fantastic Beasts series, which is where, you know, this is really, there's one of the few places in this whole series where we really kind of get a picture of what is coming, you know, in that series. Mm-hmm. So, and then
this whole book really overlaps with that series. Yeah.
And then, of course, I love that he sees Krum pull out his wand, and which sounds so dirty, but it isn't. I love it because
he literally pulls a wand out of his pocket.
They're watching Luna dance, and like, what is she doing? And he's like, oh, she's probably just trying to get rid of a waxpert Harry who recognized the symptoms, which is a reference back to, you know, one of the first conversations he and Luna had, which is hilarious. And like you mentioned, Harry is able to remember now why he tied the idea of Grigorovitch to Quidditch, because Grigorovitch made Victor Krum's wand. And of course, he knows this from, you know, the Triwizard Tournament. I love how he plays it off like, oh, it's just in a fan magazine. And Victor's like, I don't remember talking about my wand in any, you know, magazines with fans. But that we learn that obviously he's a wand maker, which is considered where he's from to be on the level, if not better. They think he's better than Ollivander. And so Harry realizes that Voldemort is looking for this wand maker because he believes Voldemort is trying to figure out exactly what happened in their last fight as much as Harry is. And maybe he'll know better than Ollivander, you know? And so it really does, like, it's starting to bring some really important things together. And I'm surprised, I forgot how quickly it happens that we kind of get this information and Harry's able to kind of piece this together.
And it's important because, you know, he kind of concocts a theory, which we'll learn in the next couple of chapters. Actually, it's quite a while if his theory is sort of correct. But yeah, it's really interesting. So we open one door and sort of close another door. We get to figure out who Grigorovich is, but now we have this whole question about what the symbol around Luna's dad's neck, this big symbol that has caused this uproar at this wedding, and clearly is a strong response because he mentions he'd duel him if he weren't at a sort of mutual acceptable event, right? Like if he just saw him on the street, he challenged him to a duel. And slowly, I think Crumb wanders off or gets up and walks away, and Harry sort of moves. He wants to fill in Ron and Hermione, but doesn't want to interrupt them. And instead, he ends up identifying another figure from early in the book, kind of sitting alone at a corner table, as Ophelius Dodge, who wrote Dumbledore's obituary in the Daily Prophet. And, you know, based on, I think that was the first chapter of this book or the second chapter of this book. And Harry has a lot of questions and wants a lot of information that he thinks maybe Mr. Dodge will have. And he even mentions when he sits down to talk to him that, like, he almost wrote him a letter after his obituary based on sort of the conflicting information he's hearing. And the rest of the conversation, I don't really think gives Harry much peace of mind, honestly.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Elpheus is letting him know that, you know, whatever Rita is saying and is going to say in her book, you shouldn't believe it. And that's when Muriel comes over and starts insinuating that everything that Rita Skeeter is saying is true. And it could have been worse because, I mean, she had, you know that Dumbledore had a squib sister and she was mistreated and her mother hated her. And like, it's like, it feels like one National Enquirer type of story after another that she keeps repeating about the Dumbledores. And, you know, there's a lot of things in here that Harry hasn't heard before, which is that Dumbledore had a sister. You know, Ophelius even mentions the fact that, you know, people kind of forget Aberforth. And they shouldn't, you know, that it's his brother. We hear that after his sister died, Aberforth punched Albus in the face, saying it was all of his fault that she's dead. You know, so like there is quite a bit of trauma and a lot of things that have happened to Dumbledore that Harry doesn't know anything about. And it bothers him that he doesn't know because he feels slightly like perturbed that Dumbledore didn't tell him any of these things and didn't confide in him in any of these things. But it also leads him to the feeling of it's beginning to chip away at his trust in Dumbledore in some ways.
Yeah. So I have sort of a little bit of a theory on this here. I feel like Harry's parents died when he was young, right? And he pretty much knew everything he could know about them. And he's already experienced everything he can experience about them. But I feel like this opens the door and he's having sort of like a when you realize your parents are human moment, but with Dumbledore, right? This is when he realizes he's not up on this pedestal where he's put him. So how far does he let him drop, right? He has this idea that Dumbledore is sort of flawless. And now he's learning that maybe that's not true. Just like what happens to a lot of us when we learn our parents aren't perfect and our parents don't have all the answers and aren't, you know, flawless either. And they make mistakes. And I feel like he's literally experiencing this. And unfortunately, he's not even alive. Dumbledore is no longer alive for him to have these conversations and get some of the closure and come to terms with it. Because now he has to determine not only how does he come to terms with that, but how does he weed out speculation versus reality, right? And while all these things could be true, he doesn't know what context they're in. He trusts him, but is questioning whether he should be trusting him and what does this look like? And, you know, he's grappling with the fact of like everything, his entire existence and his entire sort of motivation in life right now are all based on one man. And he's put all of his eggs in one basket. And now is that really the way he should be doing it? And so it's a tough time for him. And, you know, amongst all of this, we're also sort of introduced to a new character who will play a part sort of later in the chapter two. We're introduced to Bathalda Bagshot. She's mentioned as a source and was close to the Dumbledores, and he kind of file. I feel like he does this thing where he like files that name away. Okay, that's an important
right because she was the. Yeah. I mean, she wrote a history of magic that they had, I think, in their very first term. You know, Hogwarts.
Yep. So, you know, he's referencing to this character that's sort of important now. And, you know, I think it's just, it's so much. He gets hit with all this information. It's super, I mean, he's conflicted. And then this sort of super epic moment happens. He doesn't even have time to process it because then something happens.
Yeah. And right, you know, before we get to that, there are a couple of things that happen. One is, I don't want to cross or just gloss over the fact that we are reminded of Aberforth, the brother of Albus, and
younger brother, I believe.
And we meet Ariana, his sister, that we didn't know existed. And like you mentioned, not only is Harry, you know, very troubled by what he's hearing, but he also comes away thinking to himself, like, did they mistreat his sister the same way that I was mistreated and locked in a cupboard? You know, like, so there's that for him.
She's locked in a basement.
Exactly.
The same, or a cellar, I think is how they refer to it.
It's, I mean, again, this, we're building all these things in that could that are starting to kind of chip away, like you said, at this perfectional picture. That's not even a word, but of Dumbledore that's in his mind. And we also learned that not only did the Dumbledores live in Godric's Hollow, but so did Bathilda Bagshot, who apparently is bonkers now these days. Like, she's gone off her rocker, which I was... there's this small bit where Rowling kind of does that thing where she inserts a lot of reality into here where... Muriel is saying that, yeah, even if she is, Rita Skeeter can get everything she wants from her. She probably knows all the tricks for, you know, getting memories out of people. And it just, it reminds you of the way in which disgusting journalists take, you know, older people who shouldn't be being interviewed, and they totally twist everything to their own advantage. And it's just one more place where she reminds us of the nastiness of the real world through Rita Skeeter. You know, this, she is skeezy, this woman, and not above misusing a you know, elderly woman who possibly may have, you know, not the best recollection anymore. It's a great reminder of the themes that she's instituted, especially all the way back there, you know, with that fourth book and that fifth book, which we're reminded of course, because of Victor Crumb being back and all this stuff. So yeah, it's a really good reminder.
Yeah, the sensationalism in journalism, right? Like, they're looking for the clickbait title. And I think to that point too, Aunt Muriel represents sort of the consumer of that, willing to buy into that. You know, she mentions what needing to place her order for the book at Flourish and Blotts when she gets home, right? Like, she, you know, they're only creating this content because we consume it, right? And she kind of points that out too. And it's just a reminder of this, the sort of disgusting and the truly harmful nature it has, right? It's incredibly harmful. And how, you know, we need to realize that and see that and understand that, and that You know, it's just so important. Yeah. So it's a great call out to that. And this is kind of both sides of it too, right? We've even seen in past situations, Mrs. Weasley falling victim to it. So, I mean, the same here, right? Yep. It's even easier for someone to fall victim to it because of how sensational this topic is and how hot button and how like heavily revered Dumbledore is, right?
Yeah.
Like there's nothing better than taking a highly revered person and smashing him to 1,000 bits.
Especially when there's nothing better than destroying a legacy. Anymore.
Right. There's nothing worse than destroying a legacy of somebody great and undermining all the amazing things they did because of, you know, their human nature. So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. And that is a really great call out of the whole of, you know, she finds every opportunity to show you how, you know, non-ethical journalism can be incredibly harmful to a society and incredibly powerful, right? An incredibly powerful tool to bring about chaos and things. Yeah, we do. We do. You have to be very careful nowadays.
Which is why nobody trusts anything anymore. Like if you're not the world's most skeptical person these days, then you're doing yourself a disservice. Because if you're just believing whatever you're reading, and I don't really care what source it's coming from, I'm just saying, you're doing yourself a disservice. So
if you're listening to what we have to say right now, you're doing yourself a disservice. I'm just kidding. No, but if you're not taking everything with a hearty dose of you know, skepticism and a hearty dose of, well, and you're not taking everything with, you know, context, right? Everyone is going to be biased. I have my biases. Matt has his biases, right? Like we all have our own spin on a story and can manipulate something to say and be whatever we want. We can sit here and wax poetic about how much we love Harry Potter, and you could also conversely tear it a new one. So, you know, there's kind of everything under the sun. So, I mean, to your point, you just have to be thoughtful about what and how you're consuming it and how you're going to apply it to your life and your world. So, after that, man, it only gets worse.
Well,
though.
And I feel so bad for Harry because he doesn't even get a chance to really have any thought process about, you know, contemplate anything or process anything he's heard because a Patronus Lynx shows up and Kingsley Shacklebolt's voice comes out saying the ministry has fallen, Scrimgeour is dead, they are coming.
And then it ends there, because why not?
Yep.
She does a great job trying to get you to keep reading chapters.
There you go. Book.
I think this is her best one, where she forces you time and time again to keep reading, right? Some of the other books, not so much. This one, I think she's really got the like cliffhanger chapter ending down pretty pat. Because this is definitely one where you want to keep reading and understand. I mean, we think we all have an idea of who they are, but we definitely want to keep reading and see what that means and what's going to happen here. And I love, we didn't mention it in a couple of chapters ago when Mr. Weasley kind of sends a Patronus ahead with a message, but I think that's the coolest thing in the entire
really
world.
Awesome.
And I totally wish I could do it. It's to me, it's the magical equivalent of running in the room ahead of somebody and shouting something and then running out to catch up to whoever. He sends a super cryptic message and, you know, Scrimgeour's dead is kind of a big deal, especially considering how Harry left it on the last, in the last chapter.
Yeah, it's true.
With his interactions with him. And if anything, it sort of justifies why Harry and them made the right decision not to trust the ministry, right? Because it's now fallen.
And I love that phrase,
yikes,
they are coming. Because it just also reminds me of Lord of the Rings these days. And they're in the Mines of Moria. Anyway, so that's the, you know, you get that picture like it's about to all go down. And it is about to all go down. But that's next week. So, Drea, before we watch it all burn to the ground, where can people find you?
Before we burn it all to the ground, y'all, you can find me in Arizona burning to the ground. Now, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. I'm under the name MattRushing02. I am here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations, so Star Wars podcast with John Mills, as we're talking about Star Wars each and every week. Two shows over on the Trek FM network as well. One's called The Orb. Chris Jones and I, when we get an opportunity, we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and doing the 602 Club, our general geek show, talking about all of those fandoms we love. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.